Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com, by VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, by Polar, blood, sweat, and data, by CaliforniaTriathlon.org, five great 2019 races, including Viking Dash Trail Run LA on April 7th, by our Challenged Athletes Foundation. This last year we sent out 2,806 grants, totaling $4.3 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. To help out, go to challengedathletes.org, and you can check out any of our interviews on iTunes or at babbittville.com. As always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, one of the premier triathletes on the planet. Her name is Camilla Peterson. Camilla, how are you?
I am doing really good, thanks.
And you're in beautiful Austria doing some testing for Red Bull.
Yes, I am in beautiful Austria. Actually, it is really beautiful. There's snow, there's sun, so you can't really complain.
So growing up, Camilla, in Denmark, what were you? Was ice hockey your first sport?
Yeah, ice hockey was my first sport. Ice hockey is big in Denmark, and, well, of course not so big when you're a girl, but I also always just wanted to be a boy, because boys always had more fun than the girls, I thought.
Exactly.
So I've always been a little, yeah. I've always been a little boy my whole childhood, and still am, so, yeah.
And so you didn't just play ice hockey. You were a national team caliber, right?
Yeah, I was. I only played on the boys' team in training and stuff. But then, of course, I came on the national team for girls.
Now, did you get, was the goal to get to the Olympics then in ice hockey? Was there ice hockey for women then?
There was ice hockey, but for Denmark, it was too small. And I was only like 14, 15 years old when I came on the national team.
Yeah.
And so if I had to go like longer up, I had to move to Canada and the U.S. And we didn't really had the money for that in my family. And so I chose to swim instead, and I got on the national team in swimming.
So you leave ice hockey and get into swimming. And what did you specialize in swimming? Were you more of a freestyle or a butterfly? What was your stroke?
My worst discipline was freestyle.
Your worst was freestyle?
Yeah.
That is funny.
That was what I was, yeah. I was breaststroke and butterfly.
Which transfer over to triathlon really well.
Yeah, it went well. Like, even though I didn't swim for 8 years at all after I stopped swimming, but yeah, I started late triathlon, but it's never too late.
Never too late. So what got you from, how far did you get with swimming? Did you get to the, you were on the national team? Did you potentially get to the Olympic trials?
No, I didn't get to, I was on the youth national team.
Uh-huh.
But never the senior national team, because I stopped when I was 19
okay.
years old. I just lost the motivation for it. And everything. So after that, I went into fitness instead and did some spinning classes and different like fitness classes because I love sport. But
right.
I got into triathlon because I missed the goal with all my training. Like, why do you work out 20, 25 hours a week without having a goal for it?
Yes.
Because I was doing my studies at the same time. So I knew myself, I can't do a sport just for fun. It's either or nothing, and it's the same with my studies. I want to do everything I do 100%, and not just 90%. I want to have 100% focus on what I do. So when I finished my study, that's why I started triathlon, because I heard that Ironman was the new extreme sport.
Yes.
And before, everybody talked about marathon, but I never ran a marathon. But then, yeah, Yeah, triathlon sounded fun, so that's how I got into triathlon.
What was your first triathlon?
It was in 2010 for a German Bundesliga team.
Oh, yeah. So you ended up the Bundesliga is awesome. That's some of the best athletes have come out of there. And so you got you were selected on a Bundesliga team pretty early.
Yeah, that was my first race I did. First race ever in Shetland.
And you were on a team.
I was actually I got started, you know Rasmus Henning?
Yes.
Yes, he actually started a youth team in Denmark. And then he heard from one of his friends that I could have some potential in triathlon. And so he contacted me and asked if I could join this team. I was still too old because I was 27, and you had to be between 15 and 23. But he put me on this youth team. And that's how I got into training, and I started training with the kind of the national team, even though I wasn't on the national team. So it went pretty fast, actually, from I started till I did my first race for a German Bundesliga team.
And how'd you do in that first race?
I finished second, so it was good.
Wow! And that was your first ever race?
Yeah, it was my first ever race.
And you took second. So now everybody knows, somebody has a little bit of talent. Because it's not like you're competing in just a recreational triathlon. If it's a Bundesliga event, these are good people.
Yeah, they were good people. I was also pretty nervous about how am I going to do. But it went pretty well. So, yeah. And then it was a lot of fun. It was fun. I started doing... So, yeah, that's why. And then I had to do short distance in the beginning because I was still new in the sport.
Right.
And the national coach said I had to get some speed because I've never been a fast runner because I've never done any running.
Right.
So I just hated those because I was most times up in the first pack on the bike. And the Europeans, the World Cups, and then I did all the work on the bike because I didn't want the good swimmers to come up. But then when every time you put the bikes down, everybody outran me. So I hated it.
You didn't like that Olympic format.
I didn't like it because I did so much work on the bike, and the good runners were always just sitting in the back most times.
Right. They're just waiting. They're going like, let her do the work. And there's no way you can't get away because the roads are usually, it's too flat. You can't really use your cycling power, and they're all right there at the end of the bike. So there's no way.
No. So I hated that format, but then I got to do my first half Ironman in 2012.
Yeah.
Or actually did my first European long distance championships in Finland in 2011, where we do the 4K swim, 120 bike, 30K run.
Yeah.
But I never ran that long. I never biked that far. But I got to do it. And I won it, so it was pretty cool.
So wait. So you'd never run that far. You never rode that far. And this, again, when it's a championship race, it's not like there's just me and my family out there. You're racing really, really good people, and you win this thing.
I raced against Kaiser.
Yes.
Sally.
Yeah.
She was there, Michelle Vesterby was there. No, it was pretty cool. It was my debut, and... I won it, so it was pretty cool. I liked the longer stuff.
Yeah, obviously. That's way better than the short stuff with people running by you.
I know. It was a lot more fun. And then my first half Ironman in 2012 at Challenge Barcelona.
Yes.
And I won that one too, so it was also pretty cool. I had a really good start into
Trudeau.
And then I did the World Championships long distance in 12, and... Colin Stephen beat me, but I was second, and then Jody Swallow third. So it was just fun.
Yeah, first, second. That's not a bad way to kick it off. Now at that point, when you're doing so well, are sponsors coming out? Are people starting to talk? Okay, look how well you're doing at the half. You should be looking at the full Ironman. How did all of the early success change you, or did it?
It didn't change me, but it was still hard because a lot of people didn't know me.
Right.
And that was also what was fun about it, because there was no expectations on you. Nobody knew who I was. Also, I did my first Ironman in Copenhagen in 2012, and I won that one too.
I see a pattern. There's a pretty cool pattern here. Yeah.
It was. I love my pattern. And the second one was Ironman Frankfurt, and I won that one too in 2013. So I had a really, really good start, but it was still hard for me to find sponsors. Like, even though I could go out and say, I'm actually European champion, I'm vice world champion.
Yeah.
But a lot of sponsors, they're actually more into guys than sponsoring girls, I figured out.
Yeah.
Because they said, if you finish fifth at the Europeans as a guy, they definitely want to sponsor you. But if you win Europeans as a girl, nah, it's not so interesting.
Interesting. That is interesting because that's probably something that happens in Europe a lot, where the guys get more support than the women do.
It's a lot better now, like also for the women in the sport, but because like Europe has also developed a lot with triathlon the last few years, but in the beginning, like 2011, 2012, it was so hard,
right?
Just to get it going. So I worked full time actually. The first 3 years, I did, even though I raced as professional, I had to work full time just to get it together with all the the economics.
Sure. What were you doing work-wise?
So, I have a master's degree in human nutrition.
Okay.
So I worked with that, but actually mostly for people teaching immigrants how to bike and how the Danish system like works, so they could more immigrate better and get a job and get into our country. So I worked a lot with those. The immigrants.
Yes.
And it was actually pretty interesting, and I actually loved it because they were so dedicated. Like grown up, you always think, how hard can it be to bike? But if you're grown up and never been on a bike, it is really hard to learn people to bike.
It's scary. It is scary to get the balance because when we learn, we're usually 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, and you're pretty close to the ground. So if you do fall, it's not that big a deal. Now all of a sudden, you're 6 foot tall, and you're on this wobbly thing, and you've never been on it before. That's scary.
It was, but it was interesting to see how dedicated people was actually to learn how to bike and learn like just regular sports because they come from another world where they don't do this. So that's what I did the first 3 years of your
career.
Traveling,
When did you get to the point where you felt you could make it without having a job, where you could focus on being a professional triathlete?
We came into 2013, and I said I made a savings since I was a kid. I've always been good at working.
Yes.
Since I was a kid, so I made some savings and said, I have to give this all-out shot. I have to give it all out and then use some of my savings on it because this doesn't work for me. I can't do a full-time job and still perform 100%. So I agreed with my where I work that I would try and quit the job and go all out for traveling. I still worked at a fitness center, so I still had my spinning classes. I still had some fitness classes. But only like 8-10 hours a week.
You would
so
be
that
a
was 2013.
You'd be a heck of a spinning instructor. I can imagine people coming into a class and having here's one of the top triathletes in the world who's teaching our class. That would be pretty cool. So talk about the accident when you were injured. When did that happen? That was 2013, correct?
Yeah, I was. That was after I won Frankfurt, and I was so high. I qualified for Kona. Everybody talked about Kona. That was what was triathlon was all about. So I was so excited that I was going to go to Kona and do my third Ironman. And the preparation up to the race went really well. I was better running, better biking, better swimming than I was before, even before I won Frankfurt. But then I was out training back home in Denmark because I was planning on going to Cozumel to do 70.3 Cozumel before going to Hawaii. So I was back home in September, and I was out training, but all of a sudden, some kids biked over the road on a pedestrian walk. They came out from the woods, and they were just biking over the road. So I tried to avoid the kids. They were only 10 years old. And I hit one of their wheels, and then I flew over the bike, and yeah, I can't remember anything after that.
Well, so, you're in an induced coma for a month. So the kids were cutting. They were cutting across the road.
Yeah, on a pedestrian walk. So they're actually supposed to not bike over the road because it was a big road. So if it's been a car, they would have been hit.
Wow.
They put me into induced coma because the pressure in my brain was so high that they couldn't. Yeah, they also have a hard time putting me into coma because I think I reacted pretty fast on the medicine they gave me.
Right.
Yeah.
So what do you remember of when you come out of that coma? And you've basically lost a month, right? What are some of your first memories? And did you have to relearn how to walk and talk? And what was the whole process?
It was a long process. The first thing I remember was I was lying in the bed, and then there was a calendar, and it said it was the 29th of September. And I remember it was August. And so I asked one of the nurses, I didn't know she was a nurse at that time. It's like, why does it say 29th of October? And she said, September. And she's like, it's the 29th of September. It's like, I have to be in Hawaii.
Right. I got to get ready. I should be in Kona right now. I overslept.
Yeah. I know. That was my first. I thought it was a dream.
Yeah.
That was the first thing I remember. And then after that, they put me into a wheelchair, and I was like, why are you doing this? It's like, you can't walk, and you're probably not going to be able to walk again. And they also told my family that I wasn't going to be able to talk again or remember because I have damage in my brain at the memory center and the speaking center. So I could speak in the beginning, but it was only a few words I had. And after that, I asked, like, what happened? Why do I look like this? Like, and then my parents told me, and then 2 minutes after, I was like, where am I? What happened? Why do I look like this? And I didn't have a bright memory the first long time. And I still don't. I just learned how to remember things now, and I also speak differently than I do before because I had to learn how to speak again. There's a lot of words that I didn't know. And the funny thing is my English is better than my Danish now because it's in the speaking center. I have the damage, but English is something I learned later. So the doctor said that something you learn later, it sits in another place in the brain.
That's amazing. So you're from Denmark, but you speak better English now.
Yeah, I do. I remember things better in English than I do remember them in Danish. It's kind of weird.
So
every time I can't find a word, I find it in English, and then, I get it translated.
Wow. So when you're dealing with something like this, you're about ready to go to Kona. It's a world championship. You're one of the fittest athletes on the planet. And the next thing you know, they're telling you you're probably going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of your life. You can barely speak, and walking is might not be an option. How hard was that?
Yeah.
What do you feel were the lowest points for you at that time?
It was hard, but then again, it just felt so unreal.
Right. Like it was somebody else. Like this was happening to somebody else.
Like, yeah. Yeah, this can be true, but I've always been a really stubborn girl.
Yes.
Like since I was a kid.
Yeah.
Like people should never tell me I can't do anything before I figure out myself that I can't do it. Because I always, also when I played ice hockey on the boys team, not many parents like there's a girl on the boys team. So you also get hit. You also get a lot of, It's not never been easy, but I just love those challenges. Like, nothing in life is easy, but you have to fight for what you want. So I have that from the beginning. Like, don't tell me I can't walk before I tried everything. If it's going to take me 2 years, then it's going to take me 2 years. I'm not going to give up before I tried everything to be able to stand on my legs again. It's the same, like, yeah, it's fine the doctors tell me something, but, yeah, I just don't believe it before.
Right.
I feel it myself, because I know my body. It's my body. I can feel the signals. I can feel, like, everything, so, yeah.
Well, you trust yourself. You've got a pretty vast background in overcoming odds, because if you're a woman or a girl on a boys' ice hockey team, the guys don't want you there at the beginning, right? And no guy wants a girl making him look bad. So you had to, that's probably one of the hardest things, right? To get that respect from the guys and be.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, and especially you didn't play one game. You played a lot.
Yeah, I got a lot of hits but just never show how much it hurts. And yeah, and then when you first get accepted, I was really accepted by the boys and some of the guys I played with. They're also still my best friends. And
right.
Yeah, it's just, it's just challenges again. Like, life is a challenge, but you just have to be able to take them up and be willing to fight for what you want. And yeah, it's the same with goals in life. Like, life is not easy.
No. When did you feel that you could become, there was a light at the end of the tunnel, you were going to walk again, and you were going to ride, run, and swim again?
I just always believed in it. I never give up hope. And then it took me 10 days before I could stand on my legs again. I fell down, like, a lot of times, like more than 10,000 times. I just got up on my feet again, just get up, up, up. And then all of a sudden I could stand on my legs, but then the next problem was, how do I move one of my feet in front of the other? Because it's also the nervous system and everything, and the brain controls the whole body. You learn that when you hit your brain and you have some brain damage. Then you actually learn how incredible brain is. But I managed, I figured out how to move one feet at a time, and it was just up and down. And then when I started to have control, I asked if I could come outside and go for a walk. And I did, and of course I'm a triathlete or an athlete, so I had my Garmin watch on my hand so I could see how far and how fast I walked.
so you could put it up on Strava so you knew what your route was. Yeah, so you could get a course record.
Important. Yeah. Well, it wasn't a course. I think I walked 3.8 kilometers an hour, so I only walked half an hour, 1.8 kilometers. And it took me half an hour.
Yeah.
And my heart rate was 171. So it was so hard to walk so slow in the beginning. But it was my first victory. So
right.
Now I could walk again. And then I just took it step by step, then more walking. And then I was a little bit nervous, like, how would I react when I got out on the bike? Because I couldn't remember the accident. So was I going to be afraid when I came out of the bike?
But
I wasn't. First time I was out biking, I loved it. It was like, it's hard to explain how happy I was being just on a city bike, but just being outside on a bike.
Well, being free and being able to go wherever you wanted.
Exactly. The swimming was a problem the first 2 months. Every time I got in the water, I got so dizzy. I couldn't see the black line in the bottom.
Wow.
It was hard. And I got a pressure in my head. It's not like a headache, but it was the pressure. It was also what I had when I was in coma. And so I tried to, then I have to keep focusing on walking and start, like, jogging again and biking and all the rehab training. Then I started to swim again, but then I learned a lot of things, that every time I breathe to the right, it's okay, but every time I'm breathing to the left, I get the dizziness. And when I first get the dizziness, it doesn't go away. So I figured out only breathing to the right. And then I figured out if there is too many at the pool at the same time, as I used to swim with the professional swimmers. But every time I did that, I got the pressure in my head. There was too many, like, surroundings around me.
Right, too many people.
I couldn't take that. I couldn't deal with that. So I had to go to the pool at the times where I know there was not so many people there to do my swims. And then I could only swim freestyle, which was good. But if I went from freestyle to backstroke, I got dizzy. And I couldn't make a flip turn. I had to just hit the edge like edge groupers do and then
right.
turn around like that. So I did that for 9 months. I was swimming on my own every day. Only freestyle. It was really boring, but that was the only thing I could do.
Wow. But within a year, you won your first world ITU title, the Tri Championships in Weihai, China. How special was that to win that, basically within a year of doctors telling you you'll never walk again?
I don't think I ever really realized it. I think I was so focused and committed, mm-hmm. mostly to come back, but also I was so thankful because there were so many people supporting me all over the world. Like, some did a run for me every day. I was in coma. They collected money for me because I might had to get sent to the U.S. to the hospital. So I had the best support from people I didn't even know. And I was just so thankful for it. And I just wanted to say thanks and show people that they actually did support a good cause.
Yeah.
So that was one of my focuses. I wanted to show the world that anything is possible and just how thankful I was for everybody that actually supported me and helped me. So when I was in Weihai, I was, of course, just so happy I was going to be able to be at the start line at the World Championships. A year ago, I was in coma, and right now I'm standing at their World Championships for professionals.
Yeah.
And I won it, of course, was even cooler. But the biggest victory for me was actually just to be on the start line.
Of course. That's. I bet your doctors were like, wait, she's doing what?
Yeah. I visited them since, and they said, it's exceptional. Like, they're so happy because it's not often they see people that was in my situation have like 50% die because it was so critical. And they've never seen many people come out the way I came out of it. So, of course, they're happy that their job worked so well.
Do you find that you appreciate sport more now than before the accident?
I don't appreciate sport more because I always loved sport. I also loved it before, but I appreciate it maybe in another way now.
Uh-huh.
I'm more careful. I listen more to my body now than I did before because I have some stuff now that I need to take care of. I have osteoporosis. I have a heart disease. So there's many things I didn't have before the accident that I have to deal with now. People don't see them. But I'm still working a lot of things, so I have to pay attention to my body. But I just appreciate that the sport, you get to know yourself, you get to know your body, you get to know what you're actually capable of. And then this sport I just love because everybody's so nice. Your competitors, it's also your friends. You get to travel around the world. You meet so many great people. And, yeah, I just love this sport.
How have you had to change? I was talking or emailing with Coach Sutton. And when did Brett Sutton come into your life? Was he coaching you before or mainly after the accident?
No, Brett suddenly started actually coaching in December 2017, so only over a year ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I came in because I had, from I started until 2017, I had the national coach from Denmark, and Michael Truger. He also coached Rasmus Henning and Torbjørn Finnballe and some of the guys, and he had me before the accident, under the accident, because the years after the accident, and he knew me well, but because I had so many challenges after the accident and we couldn't solve them. He told me he thought it was a good idea for me to change coach, but I liked him because I felt comfortable with him. He knew me, he knew my challenges.
Right.
But he told me that I should go find a coach, and Brett Sutton would fit perfect for me. So I contacted Brett Sutton and asked if we could maybe have a meeting, and then I had a talk with him and told him my story and all my challenges and if he could be interested, and he said he could see some potential in me. He also knew I had some challenges, and he would but he liked challenges, and he could still see there was something left in me that I haven't found yet. So he said yes, and we started in December 2017.
And so he was telling me that he because of, obviously, the damage, that he tries to keep a lot of your cycling workouts indoors and running the treadmill and things like that. Has that made a difference?
Yeah. Like, first, I was like, oh, I hate, like...
Yeah, you want to be outside, right? I know.
I want to be outside, but still, again, I still love my spinning classes. So we combine it, and he is pretty good because he knows I love my spinning classes. When I'm home in Denmark, I do some of the session on spinning classes because spinning classes is always hard.
Right.
But yeah, he wanted me to go because he says I also had a brain concussion in October, or yeah. And after that, he says, your brain is so fragile after what it's been through. So, we don't really have time for more brain concussion or damage.
No.
So I should do most of my rides indoor. And most road, like runs, I do outdoor. He gave me some session on the treadmill, but I like that's how it is. And I'm if that's what I need to do, then I do it. Like, I don't really question mark what he tells me to do. Sometimes, of course, I think, oh, really? Like, I would really do that. But there's a point in everything he tells you. And if you don't trust your coach, it's not the coach you should have. So I trust everything he says, even though sometimes it sounds so weird, but there's a point, there's a meaning in everything he tells you to do. So that's why I love to have him as a coach. I love the new challenges and new things he gives me, and I've learned so much since I changed coach.
What is the plan for this year? I think you've already qualified for Kona 2019, right?
Yeah, I already qualified. We took Ironman Wales as the first qualification for Kona, and we picked it because it's cold. And it's a challenging course. And so I did that, and I knew, well, Lucy Gossett won, but I knew she would also say no for her slot because she said she retired last year, but she didn't. I qualified for that, and that's what we have in focus this year. And we still have to do some races to try to figure out to solve the problems I have, because my biggest problem is I can't keep any hydration in me.
That's a problem.
I throw up on the bike. That's a big problem,
yes,
especially in Hawaii.
Especially in Hawaii. You finished 11th in Hawaii a couple years ago, right?
I finished 8th in 15 and 11th in 16.
That's right, yeah. So 8th and 11th.
Yeah.
And getting 8th after what you had been through, that had to be so special.
It was special, but I still had the same problems as I have now, and I couldn't keep hydration in me. So it was a hard fight, and I don't feel I belong number 8. I I felt I belonged up higher because I knew I was better. But
right.
when you everybody knows that, like for themselves also, everybody says they're not happy. But of course, I was really happy, but I was also unhappy. Like
you had higher expectations.
Higher.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also, like, if I'd been there in 2013, I would love to think about, could I have done a top three then?
Right.
Or couldn't I? Like, you can never tell because I was in coma at that time. So, yeah, I know I'm going to go to Hawaii. I won the Europeans on 70.3 long distance, full Ironman. I won the World Championships long Ironman. I just need to do well in Kona. That's still my biggest goal.
And how are you addressing the whole deal of not being able to keep not being able to stay hydrated? Is the fact that you finished 8th and 11th, not being able to keep fluid in, that's amazing.
I would say it's the hardest mental fight I've been through, just to keep fighting, because your body is totally shut down. But I think my body have learned how to work without any energy and hydration in it. But still, it's not really healthy for the body either. So that's why we were trying to work different things out. And I wouldn't say people should try this at home, but we're trying to do training session where I go longer ride without any energy because my body has to learn how to work and deal with it. I do some days before a long day, I don't eat really much because, again, my body has to learn how to cope and work with that. And a body can do a lot. You just need to give it time to learn how to work with it.
What are the issues that you deal with from the accident or from that you have to deal with on a daily basis?
Of course, I have the osteoporosis, so I have to be careful with the run. But Brett knows it, and he's such a good guy, smart guy. So I do actually twice as much running now with him than I did before. But I've never had any issues or any injuries or like signs of it. But I have to pay attention to all these things, and
yes.
Then I have the heart disease, so I can't take any antibiotics because it can give me a heart attack.
Yes.
So the doctors told me either it's going to be a pacemaker or a beta block, but I said no to both because then I can't do my sport. So I have to pay attention. Maybe I get a pacemaker when I'm done traveling.
Yes, right.
But until then, when I don't have any feeling to it, I'm good with it. And then I don't have so much energy as I did before. Like, a day of traveling has never been hard for me, but it is now. I still get pressure in my head when I get up in the altitude.
Right, yeah.
I still get really tired of it. I can't be around too many people. I can't go too many new places because it's too many new impressions. And I never had troubles with that, but I do now. It takes so much and much energy out of me than before. So, actually, I never say yes to birthdays back home because then I can't do my training and I can't have focus on it. So my family and my friends know it, and they know I don't have time to visit and spend time with them when I'm home, and they accept it. Because they know it's only a certain time, and they know I will regret it when I'm done if I haven't tried to do everything possible. So for me, I never go to birthday parties or anything like that because it's actually harder for me than going out biking 5-6 hours.
So did the heart issue, that start after the accident? Was it related at all, or was that more congenital, just something hereditary?
No, I never had troubles with going. I've always been so social. I always loved going out. I could have a full-time job. I could train full-time. I could travel. I could do all that before the accident. But after that's also why I had to say no to a lot of my classes at the fitness center. So before I had 8-10 classes a week, now I only have one because I don't have time or energy to do more.
Right.
If I also have to do my training and get the most out of it.
Did the heart issue, when did that come up? Was that a couple of years after the accident? And was that related? The heart issue, was that related to the accident?
It was pretty much the first year went really well, but I figured out the first time I traveled, I could sometimes just go in, shut the door and cry because what is going on? Why do I have such a pressure in my head? Why can't I start, get not nausea, but see unclear, an unclear vision? Because there were so many impressions and so many people. All of a sudden you couldn't see the people's faces. So it was really frightening for me in the beginning.
Yeah.
But also just being home, walking up and down the street, all of a sudden people knew who you was because you've been out for an accident. But I felt so uncomfortable because can you please just leave me alone? So I needed time every day to go in, shut all lights, all noises, no phone on me, nothing. And I have to lay for an hour, total darkness, no voices, no nothing. I had to do that every day because my brain needed some quiet time. And it was so weird for me because I never had any issues with that. I could cope with 2,000 things at the same time, and all of a sudden I could only deal with one or two times at the same time. And it's been really hard, and I think that's also why I haven't performed well the last few years, because it's not overtraining, but the brain is kind of stressed. Or I don't know how to pronounce it.
Just your brain is just on overload all the time.
Yeah.
And that wears you out.
Yeah, it wears me out. And you can also, I like being an inspiration to people. So I also, I'm an ambassador for kids with chronic diseases. And I'm also an ambassador for grown-ups and kids with brain damage.
Yes.
And I sometimes go out and hold speeches to tell people, I also have issues. I know I perform well, but that's what people see from the outside. They don't see what's in the inside. They don't see how much I actually suffer or how many problems I actually have. I'm still a happy girl. I still smile all the time, and I feel the most lucky girl, but I still have bad times. I still have times where it's just too much. It's just too hard. It is hard, and it's frustrating that nobody can tell me some of the problems I'm dealing with. Why they can't tell me what it is? But it's because you can't compare people with brain injuries, especially because there's not many people with brain injuries like the injuries I have that does Ironmans.
Right. And what's fascinating is, because we did our Challenge Athletes Foundation, what I hear a lot is if somebody's, somebody's dealing with a PTSD or they're dealing with brain injuries, they talk about, when somebody's in a wheelchair, you can see what they're dealing with. When you can see somebody with a prosthetic leg, you can see what they're dealing with. When you've got a brain injury of some sort, people don't see it because you look fine. So they don't understand what issues you're dealing with because you look fine.
I look fine. I can do everything. And everybody is also surprised every time I say, I have issues. I can't. If you think about it, my brain was the size of a basketball before. Now my brain is the size on a tennis ball. But I still have to manage the same thing.
Oh, that's a great way to describe that. So basically, your brain is dealing with what it was dealing with before, but it's a quarter of the size.
Yeah, and but I still have to. That's why I still have to. I just have to say no to some of the more important things right now, because otherwise I don't have space for the important things right now. So people understand it better when I tell it that way. And I also got it because I went to a neurologist and they made some measures in my brain with like stuff, and they also explained it to me, not that way, but in a way they made a drawing to see, this is your brain, right? Was before, because I made the same test before the accident,
right?
And then I did it after the accident. So it was, for me, it was nice to see that it's not just things I make up for myself, but I could see that there was issues in my brain. Like, it don't have the same capability as it did before. And I just have to accept it. And it's the same with remembering. Like, I have a hard time remembering things when people tell me.
Sure.
So if I make things, I have to tell people they need to send me an email or a text message so I can read it myself, because if I read it, I remember it. But if people tell me, I feel I remember it, but 5 minutes later, I forgot.
Well, the nice thing is that you know what your limitations are. So you're able to say,
yeah,
hey,
you need
to put that in writing or else I'll forget about it.
Yeah, so I learned that along the way, but nobody have told me what I can do. And the same also when I did my rehab, like what I didn't get anything from the doctors. I just figured out myself how to get my brain to function again. Like, for example, what I did figure out was making a puzzle. Mm-hmm. It was so hard, but I needed to do it to concentrate, because I could see how the puzzle should look like. But then how did I get the pieces to get together so it looked like the painting it should look like? It was really, really hard, and people also think it sounds so ridiculous, like making a puzzle is not hard. But it is when you actually have the issues I had.
Absolutely.
So I did that in the beginning because I had to concentrate. I had to focus in a long time. So I started with just 100 pieces of bricks, and then I went up to 1,000. And then I went up to 1,000, but with some 3D things in. So
wow.
I had to think even more. But it helped me a lot about thinking, about concentrating. And I could use that in my sport, because our sport also needs a lot of concentration.
No question. Yeah, when you're on the bike, when you're swimming, when you're running, transition, it's all about focus.
Focus, especially in such a long term. So that's how I figured out to work with my concentration and focus.
Camilla, I really appreciate you taking so much time. So with the heart issue that you mentioned, was the heart issue related at all to the accident, or was that just a hereditary heart issue that you have to deal with?
It came after the accident. I made a lot of EKGs before.
Yeah.
And they never found anything, but after the accident, they could see that there was something that shouldn't be there. But they just say it's a genetic thing.
Right.
But everybody in my family has been tested now, genetic, and nobody has it.
Mm.
So the doctors can't, of course, say if it's directly from the accident or if it's something under the accident because of all the medicine I got or what the treatments I got.
Mm, that's a good point.
They can't give a direct answer. So.
Right. So you just deal with it.
It could be, yeah, I just deal with it.
You're the best. Camilla, thank you so much for taking so much time. I can't wait to see you racing in Kona this year. That's going to be really, really fun.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Camilla Peterson has been our guest again. We're brought to you by Tough Man Triathlon Series, toughmantri.com, by VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, by Polar, Blood, Sweat, and Data, by CaliforniaTriathlon.org. Five great 2019 race options, including Viking Dash Trail Run LA on April 7th, by our Challenged Athletes Foundation. This last year, we sent out 2,806 grants, totaling $4.3 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on BabbittVille.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here.